Welcome to the Winged Hazaar Pubcast. From fantasy to sci-fi to history and horror, your hosts are about to take you on a journey through all things Winged Hazaar Publishing. Sit back and relax as we talk about writing, gaming, as well as interview some of your favorite authors. Let's wing it.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Winged Hazaar Pubcast. Today's episode is part two of a two-part series in which I'm joined by Ben Stoddard and talking with Mark Barber about the Kings of War novels that he's done with us. All right, Mark, so the biggest thing that you focus on in your works is you want the characters to feel real and three-dimensional. We've touched on this a little bit on the first episode. And, you know, in general, you and I have talked about this, and it's helped me to strengthen my own writing. Your heroes are all heroic in some way, but they have flaws. You know, your villains are never truly evil. They have some sort of redeeming factor, a factor that makes them seem human, the kind of, you know, they're like you said, they're not all mustache-twirling villains. But let's talk about this in regards to your work. Like, how do you structure your characters so that way they have, the heroes are hero, but they have flaws, and the villains are not all completely true evil?
Oh, gosh. I think the villains are a little bit easier to do with that, and that this is a well-trodden path. This is, in some ways, kind of writing 101, is that a compelling villain is a villain who doesn't think they're a villain. So that's easier to do with some than with others. What we got? I'm writing a sequel to Pious at the moment. There's three factions in it. One of them's good old cliched pirates who I love to write, but why do pirates do piracy? Well, in the real world, a lot of it is out of desperation because it's that or nothing, it's that or starve. So instead of just making it all about kind of saying our mateys and brutalizing people for plunder, it's having that actually these are people who do bad things, but it's out of desperation. If you then go to something like Abyssal characters, that's a bit trickier to kind of market. It's his a real old-fashioned view of a demon, a kind of Dante's Inferno sort of red skin, horns, trident, all that stuff. But how do you make someone like that who doesn't think that they're the bad guy, which is what I try to do in Steps to Deliverance by saying they don't think they're the bad guy, they think they're necessary for balance and also for justice, effectively, for evil people to get what they deserve in the afterlife, which is a very, very dark concept about that it's not about redemption, it's about punishment. But that was kind of what I tried to put into their mind to say that they think they have a place in the food chain, and that's why they do what they do. So that's it with the villains, I think, is to try and just give them a justification and motive for why they do what they do and that they don't think it's wrong. Otherwise, they are just a cliche.
I think you do that really well with the Steps to Deliverance antagonist and then on in Hero Falling. Was it? No, Faith Aligned. Because Dion is a Basileian that falls to the dark side, and you're able to show that humanity part. But Ambira, you know, she was kind of like less of a three-dimensional villain, but then in Faith Aligned, you really were able to show Abyssals have humanizing aspects to them as well, and you showed like Ambira in life and what caused her to go that way, and show like the desperation. So I feel like you did one of the most monumental tasks of making demons, like the ultimate evil, have some type of humanization. And I think that's a really, really difficult thing to do.
Ambira and trying to humanize that character, because I think that was a two-dimensional mustache-twirling villain in Steps to Deliverance. But I had a weekend where it was just me and my son, for whatever reason. I think, you know, the rest of the family were doing stuff. And I don't know why. I don't know why, but I took him to Bodmin Jail for a day out. Why would you do that to a child? Because Bodmin Jail, you guys won't know on your side of it, it markets itself as like it's a museum, it's an experience, it's a fun day out for the family. Anyway, it's one of the last locations in the UK that executed criminals. It's all kind of original, and it's also reputedly, depending on what your belief system is, one of the most haunted locations in all of the UK. So I took my son there. Why wouldn't you? You know, and both of us left deeply traumatized. But I was building up for the ideas for Faith Aligned at the time, and seeing what a convicted criminal in that era, that final walk from your cell to your place of execution, what you go past, what actually happened in history for real, and walking on those cobbled stones and just trying to imagine and visualize it was utterly, utterly harrowing. And that's how I wrote Ambira's death. Was based on all of that. Every single detail is based on reality from decades past. So that was kind of how I got that out, and to try and squeeze just some shred of sympathy for what is a really horrible character.
I think Ambira is a good example of taking a character that didn't have enough, that was really almost a tertiary character in Steps to Deliverance. She was basically just there to be the villain, to be the henchman, to be, you know, the Goldar to the Power Rangers, if you get that reference. But
yep.
kind of that aspect of it. And then yeah, you take her to a different level, and you actually, I thought that was a very interesting in that morbid sense that I'm insanely drawn to and probably should see somebody about. But I found that was a very interesting scene, and it did give me that feeling of, okay, I kind of like Ambira more. The other characters that I want to pivot to a little bit that you wrote some villains for, these guys were like villains. The three necromancers, and their names are escaping me, that are in Faith Aligned. I thought those were excellent. Almost caricatures in certain aspects of it, especially the one that was the zombie mom. She was she was probably my favorite one, because she was just she leaned so heavily into the ick factor that is so associated with that aspect, and the way that their armies are represented, and segueing a little ways away from the character development and all that kind of stuff. I thought you did a really fascinating job of representing, because there's so many different builds that the undead army can have, that you can have the zombie shambling horde, or you can have the quick werewolves, or you can have the shambling skeletons that are these, you know, of glory of a bygone era kind of thing, that have stayed out too long kind of thing and shriveled up. And so you've got these three different aspects, which are three very prominent builds of armies for the undead in that. And you represent them really well, and they're really great villains. They definitely didn't have the depth that Ambira had for her character arc that she had in that story. And her relationship with the primary necromancer was pure ick, by the way. Thank you for that. But what was your thought process that went into them?
Was Hezekiah the primary one of the necromancers? Well, that six are, I'm trying to remember. That they all start to sixus. They all start to merge into one characters after a while, don't they? When you've written a few stories, and particularly when they meet a grisly demise, and you don't need to keep them on hold. Initially, what it came from was before Winged Hussar got the contract for the Kings of War novels, there were a couple of different iterations of Kings of War fiction. One of which was a book to support the original Dungeon Saga. And that Dungeon Saga novel, which was pre-Winged Hussar, that goes some detail into saying, so in this setting, here's how necromancy works, here's how magic works. Dungeon Saga is also, I think, really good, that because you get these decks of different disciplines, aeromancy, pyromancy, all that sort of stuff, you get an idea of how would a mage do what they do, and that includes necromancy. So I took that. I took what had been written before, because even though it's pre-Winged Hussar, I thought it'd be nice to nod towards it and say, we're still acknowledging that. We haven't come here and done the great Etch-a-Sketch, Control-Alt-Delete everything beforehand. So let's keep it going. So I took that author's portrayal of necromancy, and I tried to develop it and keep going with it. and pay the respects to someone else who'd come before. That's where that original Necromancer came from, and explaining how it all works. Because there's also, you know, without getting too far into it, there's really weird questions of, okay, so you've animated a dead body to hold a sword and do stuff for you. But that dead body, right, so it's not sentient. It's not a sentient undead. It's a mindless, just a bunch of animated skeleton. Okay, why not just animate the arm and the sword then? Why animate the whole thing? What's the point? So you need to have some kind of reasoning behind it, and that's kind of why I hinted more at the muscle memory side of thing, to say that locked within, even though there's no thought process, there's no consciousness within it, there is memory, and there's the skills and the drill of soldiers. It's still there within these skeletal spearmen, whatever it was, that there's something to draw on. That's the point in animating a body, not just a limb. That was the first one. And then, exactly as you said, it came to the point where it's like, okay, I need this battle I'd thought up between the undead and the Nightstalkers, but the character we had just didn't have enough clout, didn't have enough power. So I thought, well, let's bring in more of these necromancers from this cult I've made up. And exactly that thought process you mentioned, Ben, I thought, well, let's do a couple of different builds. And they are, I think they are kind of, there's definitely tropes. So I thought it'd be good to bring in these completely different aspects and see. So, yeah.
Well, and I would like to insert here that tropes aren't a bad thing if used properly,
right, too.
They are tools in a grander scheme.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And I think we've talked about this before, haven't we, Brandon, in some of the earlier episodes?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that was the whole thing, that just like when I was back going, when I was writing bolt action stuff, you think, if you're portraying the Second World War, I brought in loads of different trades like military police, chaplain, all this sort of stuff, and thought, if this is someone's grandparents, wouldn't it be cool to find a way to get what people's family did in World War II onto the tabletop and into the game in a respectful way? And in a similar way, if I'm writing about a faction, I'm thinking, you don't want to just say, right, have every single troop type there, because it just won't work. It'll look a bit silly. But if you can try and get more than someone who's spent 5-6 years painting, collecting, going to tournaments, if you can try and say, here is this unit that you've put your heart and soul into painting and using, here's how they actually are in the real life of this fictitious world. So that was why I wanted to try and do more with the undead stuff.
I want to shift gears a little bit from the necromancers, and I want to go into Estelle, because Estelle was kind of a secondary protagonist to Orion. And what we talked about, she wasn't originally even supposed to be one of the top protagonists in Steps. But now you've made her a protagonist of Hero Falling, and she's a very powerful character, both emotionally and physically. But she goes through her own struggles. You know, we see the whole keeping up appearances thing is kind of one of her flaws, we'll say, is she plays too much into it because of her history. And with men writing women characters, sometimes, especially nowadays, you can face a lot of criticisms. Did you get a lot of feedback from women? And like, did you show your wife Estelle before we went to final draft? Like, what was the thought process in creating her and the feedback you got?
That's interesting that you'd ask that specific question, because I know we haven't actually spoken about that, but Estelle was to a large part written by my wife. Yeah. I think that you do have to be really conscious about, if you're trying to write from a point of view that you fundamentally do not understand, you got to dig deep and find help and do your research. And for something as, on the face of it, simple as trying to put yourself in the shoes of someone who's another sex or gender, I don't think you can just leap into that. I mentioned in the last one with Constance, I just wrote a person. I just tried to write a human being, and I didn't think about that. And it didn't matter. With Estelle, it did, because this is a character who, that's something hugely important to that character. So yeah, what I did was, I said, I got this concept, I got this idea. And in fact, if memory serves, the concept and the idea came from when, because my son, I got Dungeon Saga as the first war game to try and get him into the hobby, because he'd seen bolt-action Sherman and Tiger tanks on my shelf, and he loved them, and he really wanted to play in bolt-action for that time at his age. It was too complicated. But Dungeon Saga, I think, is a really good entry game for younger kids into the hobby, because it's slick, fast, simple. It's great. And so my wife said she wanted to support as well. She wanted to play. And so we threw it and said, you know, custom characters, do all that stuff. And she basically made Estelle. That was what the character she wanted to use to play this game. Something very similar, at least. So it was logical to then say, well, here's a character concept I'm going to use in a story. And so it's certainly motivation and dialogue. If it's a female character, I will... So it was to start with, it would go by my wife, then some of her friends got interested in this, so it's now like almost a mini committee of women that with female characters. I'll send it to and say, what do you think about this? And it's quite funny because the answer is invariably to push further, that I'm not daring enough, that I'm not pushing the boat out enough, and which is something I can get quite uncomfortable with. So yeah, that's kind of where that character came from, and certainly the vanity was that her vanity is her Shakespearean tragic flaw, I guess. That it is all about keeping up appearances, that it is all about wanting to be centre of attention, and what's the motivation of that character? Estelle is a character who 500 years from now wants to be remembered in legend, and wants to have paintings of doing heroic things in museums, and wants to be the subject of songs and plays. That's that character's motivation.
That's really cool. I didn't know that. And I feel like it must have... Something along those lines had to come up in conversation before, but I didn't know that, you know, that was your wife's character. And now you've kind of made Kings of War a family affair with your different characters. So I'm just going to have to wait to see what character your daughter comes up with. And, you know, then we'll have the whole family.
That'll be a magic rainbow mermaid unicorn, I'd imagine, with the way things are trending at the moment. But we'll see, there'll definitely be unicorns in there somewhere. It's too much of a jump to say that Estelle was my wife's character. Estelle was based on the concept of when I was playing Dungeon Saga with a family, of what the sort of character I saw my wife immediately went for, which is basically hard-hitting, sexy, attired femme fatale. So it's like, okay, cool. If that's what, you know, that was what drawn, I was like, okay, well, I'll try and go with that. And whereas my son, and with Zake the Salamander Mage, no, that is absolutely direct. That is a facsimile. That's a photocopy exactly of what my son had made for Dungeon Saga.
And we'll get into his character in a little bit, but I want to touch a little bit more on Estelle. One of the things that you kind of brought to the table to make her very unique, and I think probably what makes her one of the most unique characters in the Kings of War novel universe, is that she's part Eloi. Eloi? Am I saying that? Okay, we're going back to naming conversations. Am I saying the word right?
That's how I understand it to be pronounced, so that's how we talk about it when we're discussing army factions and such.
Okay, so you've made her part Eloi, similar to... The only other character that exists currently is Grandmaster Gnaeus Sallustis. Again, I think I'm pronouncing that right. But what was your thought process doing that? How does it play into her character? Like, what was the thought process of that?
I saw Gnaeus. Let's go with that. Let's pronounce it Gnaeus. I read about that Gnaeus when I was doing the research for the Paladin side of things with Steps to Deliverance. I thought it was a cool idea. And I think the idea of that kind of half-angel, half-mortal character is something that some aspects of Mantic management now aren't as keen on. Because I remember sometime down the line, there was a conversation at one point of, this character Estelle is a what, sorry? Yeah, and where, you know, there was a bit of a where... Was that approved? And it's like, it wasn't approved. It was written by Mantic. That's where the concept came from. I didn't invent it. So, but whereas you've got this one character who is, again, the lawful good paladin trope, is amazing at everything, is focused, is driven, is altruistic, and as such has achieved the top rank, and is just an achiever, but a really good person with it. I was like, well... What if you had someone who maybe had barriers, had hurdles in the way, but still had all of that ability, but because of childhood experiences, didn't become that person? who then ends up getting frustrated by it, gets angry by it, but also has all of the abilities that, as she says in her own words, it's not that she's superhuman, it's not that she's better. It's just that whether if someone wants to be in peak physical condition, they may have to put in years of training. With her, it'll be a few weeks. If she wants to do something, it's really simple to apply yourself to it, because that's her kind of supernatural heritage. So, yeah, that was the kind of thought process behind that, was just to have someone who, one of these people you meet at school, who's really annoyingly naturally good at absolutely everything. But just to have a kind of justification behind it and say, well, there's a reason why in this case.
And if memory serves right, doesn't she necessarily sort of hate that side of her? And she in some cases, she enjoys being better, especially with conversations with Thessalir. It feels like there's some times where she feels like she's gloating about how much better she is. And then there's other times I feel like she hates the fact that it all comes naturally and she wants to be a little bit more normal, like her.
If that's what's come across, that's interesting, that's cool. And I'm glad that there's different facets come across. That isn't how I visualized it. I always kind of imagined that there was a lot more arrogance to her than that. This is someone who has been through their whole life coming top at everything with little effort. And I don't think, because yeah, she's nudging 30. I think she's in her early 30s by this point. So she's been through 3 decades of life of just excelling at everything. And I think it would be hard to become a well-rounded person when you're that good at so many things. Which is kind of why I ride her the way she is, that there is just this constant vanity and arrogance.
Yeah, I definitely get the arrogance part of it. I think I'm remembering a particular scene where the two of them have a heart-to-heart, and I think it's at the tavern.
Yeah, I know which scene you mean, yeah.
So I feel like at that part she was sort of empathizing with Thessalir, saying that she just is so much better because of her heritage, but she sometimes wishes she weren't. But I could be remembering that wrong.
I remember that because, Thessalar, however we're going to pronounce it, she's coming at it from the point of view saying she's an elf. And if you look at the stats of the elves and just across the fantasy genre in general, elves tend to be better at most things. They live longer. They're more agile. They're faster. They're more skillful. They're more intelligent. They're the cheat mode. It's like playing Russians in War Thunder. You're just better at everything. And for anyone who plays War Thunder, I hope you get the reference. Yeah, it's she then has events in her past and walks away from her culture and heritage and her people. And there's a part at the back of her mind, this subconscious part, which says, I'm going to go hang out with humans because I will be a god amongst mortals as an elf around surrounded by humans. And then of all the people to meets one of the perhaps 3 or 4 on the entire planet who is half Illoi and has those dreams of seeming kind of really good at everything shattered. So that's kind of part of the frustration between those two, is that there is a little bit, well, there's clearly a lot of competition between them. And I didn't want to write the cliched elf who's noble and perhaps a bit aloof and a bit removed. I wrote Thessalar as a verbal bully was what I had in mind. And that's her journey. Is whereas Orion was a physical bully and someone who beats people up for looking at him wrong, effectively, and looking and picking fights. Thessalar is highly, highly, highly intelligent, but has a whole load of baggage from her past, which makes her have chips on shoulders about everything. And so is constantly verbally picking holes in people and making them feel worse about themselves, and that's something that she has to get over.
All right, so we're going to go into the character Thessalar in a little bit, but can you explain the title of Hero Falling and how it relates to Estelle? I know there's one of those scenes of the like, oh, there it is, because the title is mentioned in text, but can you go over why you chose that title for this book?
Yeah, it was because it was her story, which was a risk. As I said, I don't like having a central character. I like the ensemble cast. So you can
chance different readers and what they like to see and the characters they read about. But because she was going to be the central character, and and knowing the motivation that I come up with the Steps to Deliverance is about being a hero for the wrong reasons. Orion's motivation of what he wants to be is the parallel character, is here's someone who wants to finish his day saying, I made a positive difference. Whereas Estelle wants to finish her day saying, I was loved and worshipped as a hero. And it's going wrong. It's going badly wrong. And she hasn't ended up where she wants to be. She's blown all of her money on an ostentatious lifestyle to show how to try and show off to people, to have every time they're off doing their adventuring stuff in a very D&D way, and then in a tavern, they'll end up in a small room. She'll end up hiring a villa. And is living this amazing lifestyle and is now flat broke, has severed ties with the sisterhood, and hasn't become a hero. So that's what it is. Hero falling isn't about dying. It's about falling from the ideal of being a hero. And that's what she refers to herself. The conversation that she has with Thessala, I'm pretty sure it's that one, where she says, always wanted to be a hero, but I think I'm falling. And it's having that realization of I've messed up here quite badly. So yeah, that was the idea.
That's cool. I liked it, and I liked seeing it in text. I'm also a really big fan of the "there it is" moments of when you use the title in the text, because when you come up with a title, there's a reason why you chose that title, whether it's tying into the theme or it's something that it happens in the book that you go, the aha, that's why it's called that. I like seeing those type of moments, so I think that was a good job with that. And staying on the topic of hero falling, this was kind of, it was one of the earlier books that we got the go-ahead to start using pre-existing Mantic characters. So why did you pick Ragran and Thessalair to be the supporting cast for Hero Falling? Was it just to complement the party setting and kind of get your traditional D&D type cast? Or was there a deeper meaning why you picked those two? Like, did you play with them in Dungeon Saga at all?
It was a little bit of both. So as Ben was saying earlier, I very much agree with cliches can be bad, but tropes not necessarily, not if they're done well. I was trying to do the trope well here. Hero Falling is a Dungeon Saga book, not a Kings of War book, which in a way means it's if you haven't played Dungeon Saga, it's a dungeon crawler board game, and they owe a lot, I think, to the original kind of concept of D&D way back in the 70s and the 80s. I don't know if it goes back as far as the 70s, certainly 80s. But this eclectic mix, this diverse cast of adventurers who all bring a different something to the party to then go and raid underground, you know, caverns and tombs and things and get treasure, and that's how they live and exist. I wanted to do that. It's been done a million times. It's fallen out of favour, but I wanted to go back to it and do that sort of thing and have it that simple. So I've then got to put a cast of characters together, and I thought, wouldn't it be kind of cool that when you get Dungeon Saga, you get pre-made characters, and actually it's only one of the expansion packs where you can make up your own. The base game, there is no choice. You have to use the pre-made characters. And the novel, which came out in the pre-Winter Tsar days, that was about those characters. They've got extra minis as well. They made white metal minis for these characters. At one point, these characters were a bit of a thing. And in fact, one of them, the elf character, is in the elf list in Kings of War, so is still a thing, is a named character. But every expansion pack you get a little cardboard kind of handout thing, which is a variation of those characters along with the new ones. And the variation, it is literally a cut and paste. It is exactly the same image. All they do is change the colours. So like in Ragran's case, the beard and the tattoo and stuff. So it's exactly the same image. They just swap colours in and out. So I thought that wouldn't it be kind of cool to try and breathe life into a couple of these characters, which may, as far as I'm aware, have been a 60-second thought process. Just, okay, we're going to make a guy called Ragran. He's going to be a variation of the barbarian you get in the core set. Cool. did that have 60 seconds of thought, make him blonde, there you go, he's good to go. Or was this someone's character from some other place where, you know, a load of heart and soul went into it? I don't know. And I don't think many people could name many of these characters from the expansion packs. I don't think they're wildly used and wildly popular. So I just thought it would be just a nice idea to take something which may have been someone's creativity years ago and is now just lying there dormant and say, well, just chuck them in a novel and let's give them a full backstory. Because each of those characters only have two paragraphs of backstory in the actual expansion packs they're from. So I haven't made up for both of them the whole backstory. I took those two paragraphs as a foundation and built out from it. So Thessalar, it does say that she's got a sharp wit. That's her characteristic. That wasn't my idea. And that something happened in her past which drove her away from her people. So I took that and thought that would be a kind of cool idea and went from there, really.
That's cool. And that whole past bit actually will coincide with a future story coming. So that'll be cool to touch base on that again.
Yeah. That's absolutely. And that's not far away now.
Yeah, Tom Fearn's Cost of Power is going to be next in my editing queue after Honor's Price. And does Thessalar make an appearance in that book? Or is it just it expands off of what was already touched upon in Hero Falling?
No, Thessalar's in it. So there's a flashback, Hero Falling, where we see what was the event which drove Thessalar away from her people. And I won't say, because it's not fair on Tom, because it's much more important to his book and his story. So I won't do any spoilers. But Tom, I spoke to on the phone about it and said, as another UK-based author, so here's a situation I'm in, and I think it would be nice, where, if possible, if it works, without forcing it and making it convoluted or anything, to have crossovers, tiny little threads connecting some of these novels to show we're all on the same page, and that we're all working together to support each other. And he agreed, which is why Thessalar's backstory is she's a cousin of the main character in Tom's book. And they're very close. It's not like a cousin you see only at Christmas. They're very close. And that event, which drove her away, is key to the main character in Tom's book. And there's... So what we did, we spoke about it, we made it all work. We sent each other... Tom sent me some extracts of what he'd written about it. So I wrote a scene... which it makes much more sense in Tom's book. So Thessalar's flashback to who she is and why she is where she is it fills in a gap in the narrative in Tom's book, with Tom's permission, and he's read through it and said, yeah, that's exactly how.
And Dungeon Crawlers in general are really good novels. I mean, Vince wanted to do that with our Story Bogo series of books. He wanted we talked about Clint Werner writing a Dungeon Crawler book because they're just really... They're great books in the setting of what they do. I mean, they are a little trite in that they've been done a lot, but you can do so much with them in such a small period of time. Your story is constrained more or less to the dungeon and what goes on there. And you can build on – it's more of a character building than anything. So I think you've done a great job with that.
There's elements of it which are that, but I think it's just in the – well, it's the opening and the end, but then there's the bits in the middle where they're not packing the – mace plus one and provisions and all that good stuff and going underground. So I didn't do it for all of it. I think, yeah, there's certainly large segments in the middle, and there's also the crossovers with where there's the flashbacks to Steps to Deliverance from both of the characters and that sort of thing. I think the original Dungeon Saga novel, which led on to this thought process and which I leaned on for the whole necromancy rules and all that good stuff, the entire novel of that is they step into the dungeon on page one and X hundred pages later they step out. That I didn't want to do. I think that can be claustrophobic. It's here it is, the whole thing's underground and there's no light and it's just wave after wave after wave of monsters and finding a bit of treasure and stuff like that. So I didn't want to do that. Which is why there's big segments where they're kind of in between. It goes more D&D and adventure-y, and it's kind of like that bit in the tavern where there's a bard in the corner and people are drinking and all the tropes. That's why I kind of went into that side of it instead of just now go on to level 6, you've just beaten the end of level bad guy kind of thing.
And you did a really good job with that. Hero Falling was a really awesome novel, and I highly recommend anybody who wants that itch of deeper character development with a big, not a big party, but, you know, with a good, close cast of characters, definitely check that one out. And I kind of want to transition a little bit into Faith Aligned by talking about, you know, relationships. Like you used Ragran and Thessalar in Hero Falling, you didn't really use any big existing characters in Faith Aligned. But we were introduced to two very important characters to Orion's story, Catrin and Edvard. So let's talk about Catrin. Was there any thought in your mind to see if the readers would buy into a Catrin and Orion romance, seeing as Steps to Deliverance ended on the two of them go their separate ways and didn't necessarily talk about their feelings? Or was it always the intention for them to be friends and foils of each other?
I wanted to have them as platonic friends. I wanted to have them as a kind of brother-sister relationship, that you've got these two people who are working within a religious order. And refer to each other as brother and sister, but it kind of follows that relationship. So there was never going to be any intended romance between them. If anything, I thought at one point of having a romance between Catrin and Edvard, but thought actually no, let's just go through the whole book with no romance. It doesn't need any. If as a second order effect. I was quite surprised and interested to have a couple of people, because you do get feedback from these things. You get the occasional message on social media and have a bit of a conversation, a pleasant conversation with a complete stranger about your book, which is really nice. I was quite surprised there was a handful of people who had a real interest in the romance side of Steps to Deliverance, which I wasn't expecting, and saying that needs to be resolved, that needs to be fixed, that didn't end the way it should. It has to have a happy ending. So, well, it's like, well, Indiana Jones and James Bond have a different love interest in every movie. So if the reader kind of... There was also a little sneaky part saying, if the reader is going at that and going, hang on, why have you brought in this young, capable, altruistic woman who's a genuinely good person, a really nice person, a really capable person, a really good fighter, leader, all this stuff, and treats Orion with respect all the way through, in case they're thinking, I don't like where this is going. He's supposed to end with Estelle. So there was a little bit of that. But yeah, that was never... It was more of a threat than a plan, of just to have another thread thrown in to keep the reader guessing, I guess.
See, that's a relief to me that you didn't plan them to be a romance, because if... That falls into the bad kind of cliche of, like you said, with James Bond, there's literally the term Bond girl, right? Because he gets a new one every time. And I feel like that cheapens relationships if every character is a potential romance interest. I feel like that's not reflective of real world and real relationships, and so therefore it kind of takes away from that aspect of what you've stated is one of your big aspects of how you write is relationships. And so I'm I'm happy to hear that you are not, that every character that comes on that is not a potential romantic partner or something along those lines, and that not all characters are, you know, the romanceable option. I was just going to lead into the next question in a more general sense. So relationships, as you've stated, are an intensely important part of any novel, but Mark, you use relationships as the driving force behind your narrative, as we've discussed. Every author has their style, and so bear with me for a second. This is going to be a very rambling question that I will get to a point here in a second, but I feel like it needs a little bit of a build-up to it. So every author has their style, and every author uses relationships as part of that. For example, I've made some comparisons between Robert Jordan. He uses relationships, but they're kind of the same relationship with every person. You knew that every woman was going to have a love-hate relationship with their romantic interest, and every man would either be stony and stoic in response, or they're going to walk on eggshells around any females, and the relationships tend to be one note, right? There's not a lot of variation in the relationships that Robert Jordan puts into his characters. Tolkien used relationships, but his focus, he was infamous for his world building, right? But because he was so focused on the history and the cultures and the languages and all of that kind of stuff, his relationships oftentimes took a back seat to all of those things. And as a result, the actions of the characters, you could feel the weight of the thousands of years of history that led up to the moment when Frodo throws the ring into the fire, or whatever the case may be. You got Frank Herbert going to the sci-fi side. He's big into psychology and cultures being the motivational forces behind it. And relationships kind of become almost like these chess pieces that a player will move across the board, and relationships are used in the same way. They're very clinical. They're very abstract. They're not... while there is romance, it's very much almost in a sterile environment kind of thing. And even the relationships between parents and children or friends, you can feel the camaraderie, but it is a secondary effect to what is going on. Now, Mark, you're the opposite of that. Your relationships form the crux of your worldview into your stories. Now, these relationships would be what I would describe as quote-unquote pure. Not as in, like, you know, there aren't, you know, baser motivations involved with it, but the relationships are the motivation in and of themselves. They're not set pieces meant to drive the story forward, but rather they are the central motivation, the emotion, the connection, rather than serving as just a plot device that enables events to unfold. Characters seem to base most of their decisions around relationships, and everything else in the story is kind of secondary to this, even victory sometimes. So even Orion, and looking at this and again analyzing relationships, he chooses to be a loner for most of Steps, and he does so because of the relationships that he had with his uncle and his redemption arc that you give, because he goes to being this jerk that totally cuts himself off from others because of his trauma, because he's afraid to get hurt again. And his redemption arc is coming to grips with the idea that he needs other people and relationships to be truly human. This also dips into Estelle doing that in Hero Falling, where we see her confronting her own abandonment issues, kind of like what Orion did. And she goes through a similar redemption arc of learning to need others in her life. Zach is a great example of how relationships drive a story. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that right. I always pronounce it as Zach. Is it Zeke?
Or
something along those lines?
He's Zake. That's
Zake.
Yeah, fortunately, because he's my son's invention. That I definitely know is canon, the pronunciation.
Definitely. We'll make sure and get that in there. It'll be right up there with Basilia versus Basalia. But Zach... Zach is another great example of how relationships in a different direction, right? So you have these two that their redemption arcs are in realizing that, hey, I can't do this alone, and relationships are important to me, which is, again, a central theme in a lot of your writing. But then you have Zake, who his actions are very simple. Like, he doesn't have a lot of complexity in what he does necessarily. And like the scene that springs to mind is when they're in the dungeon and he wanders off and gets a piece of treasure. And I can totally imagine how that looked on the tabletop of you're over there fighting a monster and you're like, hey, I need backup. And your son just goes, hey, cool, shiny thing over here. I've totally seen that happen with friends and stuff like that. He's like, dude, what are you doing? We're dying over here. And you went after loot, seriously. And it's a great thing, but it's because of his relationships, you come to find out, that are driving his actions, and it kind of gives the character that necessary complexity, so he's not a one note kind of what is he doing kind of thing. And learning that he's trying to save his family and how much he loves being a parent and his community and having that be the focus of what that character is, And the fact that he's trying to amass wealth for that purpose could be shown in countless ways that would turn his actions into simple plot devices. But the way that you develop and the care that you give in crafting his relationships, this makes him into an interesting character as a result. Now, finally, we're getting to my question, I promise. It is obvious that that relationships are important to you and that you value especially familial and intimate relationships. Is this a conscious choice in a character development?
Oh, man. I'm going to say no. I'm going to say no, it isn't. I think, because there's no quick answer to a question with so many facets to it. Top line down, quick answer. In most cases, but certainly not all, I think this is happening at a subconscious level. However, some of the aspects you've drawn on there, so you talk through the similarity between Orion's redemption arc and Estelle's in the next novel. And I'm thinking, ah, oh, jeez, I did repeat myself, didn't I? Whereas when we then look at Zake's side of things, that was meticulously planned. So it depends on which one. That was very much a conscious decision.
Well, I just wanted to point out, I don't think that you're repeating yourself. I think it works in the comparison between Estelle and Orion because you have these two characters are... The reason that there's such chemistry between them is that there is more similarities between them than you first realize. And the fact that they are both dealing with trauma in similar, like the root of their actions is similar. And the way that they're dealing with that ends in the same, they both have the same end goal in the fact that Orion wants to get stronger, but he wants to keep himself separate from others because he doesn't want to get hurt. And Estelle wants to be loved by others, but at a distance because she doesn't want to get hurt again. And because these two are such a close mirror, I think that's why their relationship has the friction that it does. And it makes sense in that regard. I don't think it's repeating each other, but rather it's showing different reflections of a similar trauma, which is a universal theme. I don't think that that is necessarily a negative thing. In fact, I would say it's not. I think it's honestly works really well in that while their stories are similar, you have grossly different reactions to how that plays out. Both of them are based on pride, but in different manifestations. You have the stoic kind of pride of I don't need anybody, and then you have the vanity kind of pride with Estelle, where I don't need anybody, I'm self-sufficient, but I still crave that confirmation, that affirmation that I am worthwhile. And so you have these two things. Orion's seeking to prove that he's worthy because he has failed in the past, and Estelle feels betrayed and wants that worthiness as well. And so because of that, that I think draws those two characters together very well. I would say that that's not repeating yourself. Rather, that is mere reflections and parallel paths, which is a viable authorial choice.
Yeah, I think when you put it in those terms, that makes more sense to me. That side of what you've just described, that was planned. That all of these, what's... When you sit down and plan a character, it can be so easy to say they're good at this, they're good at that, they're skilled here, they're skilled there. I find it more enjoyable and more interesting to say what are the hang-ups, vices, problems, and weaknesses. And so they both do have that similar journey as such, I guess. But it comes to that end goal of why does anyone go through things? What is their desired end state? What's the motivation behind it? And for Orion, it is to be able to look in the mirror at the end of the day and say, "I did something good." That's his drive. By the time he gets over being a thug, that's what he wants to do to redeem himself. Is say, "What did I do to make a stranger's life better? That I've got all this power and ability to fight and kill. What did I do to protect people who couldn't protect themselves?" That's his big driver. Whereas Estelle's is a lot less lawful good. Hers is, how many people love and idolize me? that's the driver, and that's and so we get to the end of our two respective novels, and I could end Orion's story there, and I think that would be a positive. He doesn't have a fairy tale happy ending, but he's made things up with his parents and he's at peace with himself, and if the story ends there, it ends there, and I think he's got a relatively happy ending. Whereas Estelle hasn't won yet. She gets two roads, literally, go north or go south. And she picks the ego road and says, instead of resolving the things, the hang-ups that is going to give me closure and comfort, I'm going to go to the next adventure and I'm going to blow stuff up and kill people and get money and fame. And chooses to do that. She takes the wrong choice. So she still hasn't... Her character arc isn't complete. That was my plan. That's what I was kind of trying to do with it.
I'm doubling back to our little man, Zake. I think... how much have I touched on this in the past? What happened with creating this character was... So my son makes his Dungeon Saga character. And exactly as you said, Ben, you have described exactly what happened. So we play a game. And for those who haven't played Dungeon Saga, there's a time limit. So like the Dungeon Master, for want of a better phrase, has got a number of cards to play. And when that card deck runs out, the heroes have run out of time. And if they haven't achieved their objectives, they've lost. So it's not all about hacky hacky killy. You've got to be fast. You've got to keep moving. And I was playing, and every single time we were playing, and this is when my son was a lot younger, he'd always go after the treasure chest. He'd always abandon the other people. And as a result, in several cases, someone would get knocked out. You'd have to double back, try and get them conscious again, get them moving forward. And you've hit your time there. You've run out. You've failed. And my son had enough about him to go, the team failed because of me. Okay. Failed because I went for the treasure chest. Okay. Oh, that was really selfish. I need to not do that. It's like, well, Dungeon Saga teaches life lessons. Great. So we play the second time. He does exactly the same. The same outcome. I've done it again, haven't I? Yeah, okay. I'm going to learn from it. Third time, exactly the same. And then he starts to get over it and stops doing it. And then I said, you know, I've got this opportunity to write this novel, and I'm thinking of making your character a thing that people will read about him in different countries and everything. And so he said, and this was his idea, he said, well, you should write him the way I play him. So you should write him that he does the wrong thing and he lets people down and that he goes after treasure. But I don't want him to be a bad guy. I want there to be a reason. And so he came up with the reason behind it, and he came up with Zake's whole backstory. So I wrote the guy, but in terms of the way he acts, the way he thinks, his priority, the fact that he is a really committed father who's got kids back home who he really misses, and that being a committed father came from the fact that his father was really committed and he had this really positive role model in his dad as he was growing up, all of that was my son's idea. He wrote the whole thing. Or at least created it and told me, here's what I want him to be, and then I just wrote it.
It seems like you're there's. I think that speaks to you as a parent, that you're doing things right, because if that's what the situation is, and it's well, no, it's very apparent that your personal self is very much injected into your characters. You can definitely see your values and your principles being. Superimposed over these characters, and we learn a lot about you as a person, and I think it speaks a lot that your son feels that way and that he draws that inspirations from that because all inspiration comes from personal experience, and if that's what he's drawing from it, I think you got a good affirmation there for you.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you. Yeah, he's probably weeks away from he'll be knocking on Brandon's door soon with novel ideas, and he'll be way better than me. So he's already got little ideas for doing like a Zake comic strip. So he does a lot of, he's you know, years older now. This is the concept for Hero Falling is years in the rearview mirror. So he's older now. He's good at drawing and sketching and stuff. So we might, on the Wing to Saw Facebook feed or webpage, see tiny little Zake comic soon, I don't know.
That would be excellent. I've oftentimes said that what Kings is missing is a graphic novel.
Absolutely.
So going back to that, you say that it's not a conscious choice, and you kind of touched on this. How how do you decide on the values and motivations of your characters then? Because not all of them can have the same thing. Not all of them can be exactly the same person that you are, or hold the same values, or even value adjacent values. So how do you decide what characters are going to have what values and their motivations, especially if you don't have your plot decided at the beginning?
It gets drawn from real life experience, with which we kind of touched on with a few things now. I'm not using this as an excuse to segue into Pius. It's just that Pius is the best example of it. So Pius has got a central cast, which is largely a whole bunch of homogenous male naval officers with almost identical backgrounds. So how do you make these characters different? And this is kind of what I've said to people who get into writing early on, and say, look, just write what you know whenever you can. It doesn't matter what it is. If your job is that you clean offices, then try and bring that even into a fantasy aspect. A self-published author I know has done a fantastic supernatural urban thriller thing, and the basis of it is a load of guys who are estate agents. And they're my favourite parts, because the banter that goes into that estate agent bit is hilarious. And you see the lived experience of knowing how stupid elements of that industry could be. So I have never been an officer on a Age of Sail frigate, but I have done some things in my life which have crossover. So therefore I could take personal experience and apply it to the characters in Pius, to the point that I hope they were all different. And then you look at Charm, the captain, who's not a nice person at all. And I think we've all met people like that who are just aggressive, angry, sarcastic, but highly intelligent leaders and managers who can publicly berate and humiliate anyone with withering sarcasm and just completely immobilize you and make you feel really small. And that's the character he is. But the question is, why? Why does someone do that? That's what I try to do with that character, is say, yeah, he's on the face of it, he's a really, really unpleasant person, but they are very good at the job. Sometimes you need a hard individual to do a hard job. And underneath it, there are reasons why people act like that. And that's what I try to do with that character. So yeah, that's it. I think it's just kind of look at interesting people I know in real life, and then think, without trying to psychoanalyze them, which I'm not qualified to do, is then just think, why do they do it? And then that's the basis of the characters for me. Long answer, sorry.
No, that's perfect. That's really good to know. And I think that's useful, especially for anybody out there that's trying to develop their own novel, because sometimes characters are the hardest part, and perspective especially. Building someone who's very different from yourself and making them seem like a real person rather than a caricature is one of the more difficult aspects of writing a story, and making and is the difference in a lot of cases between a mediocre story and a good story, or a good story and a great story, right? If you have too many one-note characters or flat characters, then the story itself falls flat. There's not enough support for it. So I think this is an excellent way to help any new authors that are thinking about writing, or that are listening to this publication or to this podcast. This is a great aspect. Might even be an interesting episode for a future one, Brandon, is what to consider when preparing to write a book, and that writing process that goes through it, because I think this is a crucial step involved in fleshing out characters and imagining them and giving them perspective. So I think this is a great answer.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the goals when we set out to do this, is not just talk about Winged Huster stuff, because, you know, there's only so much we can talk about before we start rehashing old subjects. But one of the other reasons why I wanted to do this is to give potential authors tips and tools on what to do, because there's a lot of podcasts out there about books. I don't necessarily think there's a lot out there on publishing. There might be a lot of writing. I don't really have a lot of experience with listening to podcasts, because I just don't have time. But I feel like what we do is a niche market that doesn't have enough exposure. So I definitely I definitely agree that those things are very important for aspiring writers to listen to and take away from. And, you know, I've said this in earlier episodes, but if people have questions or if they have feedback about these type of subjects, definitely let us know. Either comment on whatever platform you're listening to this on, or go to our Facebook and send us messages, because Mark and I have direct access to the Facebook page, and we can answer any of those questions or see any of the feedback that people have. Before we go on, I want to just slide into a quick commercial break. So I want to thank today's sponsor, On Military Matters, your source for new, used, and out-of-print books in military history, wargaming, and modeling. Check them out at onmilitarymatters.com and make sure to sign up for the weekly e-flyer. We've kind of touched on a lot of different aspects of your novels, Mark. It's a fascinating experience. I really don't want to cut this short, but we are kind of going over on time, so I do want to. There are a couple other characters I just want to hit on real quick, mostly being Edvard and James, because those are the two characters I feel like we haven't really touched on too much. But Edvard was an interesting character because he was a Brotherhood character. Well, Brother Mark, I should say. But I wanted to know, was there any. Did you bring any of your original Brotherhood novel idea into his character, or was he just created uniquely and independently for Faith Aligned?
The latter, really. I thought about it, because as we've said on previous ones, Steps to Deliverance, the original concept was it was going to be Brotherhood characters, not basically a Yayan. So, but I just thought, let's come at this with a fresh pair of eyes. I want a character who, I want Orion to fail in this story. What's he going to fail at? Well, he's pretty hench with the swordplay and headbutting people and all that stuff. But what are the threats? Are there on table rolling dice in the game? There's a lot more to the game than that. So I'm going to have him fail with something more arcane, more magical, more nerve based. So, therefore, who's going to pick him up again? Who's going to save him? And that's who Edvard is. So I want a character whose faith is absolutely rock solid, and who is absolutely fearless, who doubts nothing, who isn't as good a fighter, but is single-minded in that aspect of the character. And that was the concept for Edvard. It was only about halfway through writing that I thought, well, why? And that was when kind of go into that he lost his wife to an illness shortly after they were married, and he's never got over it. And all this is just, he's got nothing to lose. He doesn't fear death, because really he wants to be united with his wife. He has his wife again. He has the faith that in the afterlife they'll be together as long as he carries on doing the right thing. So he's utterly fearless because he wants to be with him. And that was kind of how I came up with that character.
That whole scene in the manor with the Night Stalkers and Edvard and Orion is powerful. That was one of my favorite scenes in Faith Aligned. I think if anybody wanted a good depiction of the Night Stalkers, I mean, the three of us touched on it with Nature's Night, because all three of us worked on Nature's Night, and it was the first iteration of the Night Stalkers in the books. But I think that whole manor scene was so powerful and so well done. So that's a great comparison of their characters and like how you build on that.
We've got a series in the UK. I can't remember that for the life of me, but when I was, again, done my stuff in the States, I know that there's channels you guys got over there which are full of ghost hunters. And those real-life ghost hunters, I mean, I'm not saying I believe in a lot of that stuff, but entertainment-wise, it is amazing. It's so watchable. Watching a load of people like wandering around in the state, in the case of US history, normally a psychiatric hospital somewhere. And so these haunted psychiatric hospitals, and then just hearing, you know, like someone drop a crumb and then all running around screaming. I love that. And that manor house side of it, with our equivalent over here, we've got castles everywhere. We need to bulldoze them down. And so castles and abbeys and all this sort of stuff. And so that whole scene and everything about it is just a concoction of every ghost cliche in the UK Ghost Hunters Handbook. So it's which I enjoyed writing. It was good fun.
It was well executed. I really liked it. I want to move on to James real quick, because James is kind of a character. He's an intriguing character, I guess, that we haven't really touched upon too much. And one of the things that you always focus on, and like Ben too, like all of our authors, it was like we were trying to world build out and make the world feel more lived in. And I think you did that first with your interlocking characters in Pius, or in your whole Kings of War series. And Pius was a good example of that, because I think it was there. I don't think it was Steps. You made the first allusion to the fact that Valletto's wife and James are they cousins? Was I right on that one?
So Valletto, when he goes home and you see his wife and his kids, his wife is James's sister.
That's it. Yep. So that's a really cool like world building. And I think you say it in such a passing detail that most people might miss it if they're not looking out for it. So there's your big connection there between the Orion series and Pius, how those are all interlaced together.
Oh, it gets worse in the sequel. It gets worse in the sequel because, as you know, that Zake's dad is a sailor in the Salamander Navy. So there's a Salamander warship, a Jakorik, in the second Armada book, and the first lieutenant, so the second in command, is Zake's dad. I don't necessarily say it, but the physical description I've kept exactly the same. The slight limp is exactly the same. And he's a tertiary character, you know, he's not a point of view character, but he's in it. And he never says, "I have a son called Zake," or anything obvious. But there's now this really convoluted link of, you know, James could say, "My sister is married to a guy who works with a woman whose best friend is your son." So... which is, yeah, I like ridiculous links like that.
Well, that's cool. And that's something that we can exclusively share here on the podcast. So before even Do You Think and Thing comes out, there's your character allusion. You can establish as canon with the different family relations in this series. James is also the first Winged Hustler publishing character with official rules to support him. How did you feel when, you know, they said, "Oh, we're going to give James rules." And does that have any effect on how you're writing him in Through Thick and Thin?
That was Matt Gilbert's idea, which was came out of nowhere. Just got this email, which was just great because it was a real first for me as well. So you know, the whole Pius thing was quick. Things had to happen fast to say get a novel to coincide with the release of this game. He'd already come out with two Boosalian captains. So every faction's got two named captains who you can pay extra points for, you get an ability. And then he just sent me an email saying, "Oh, by the way, whilst you've been doing all of this, I just thought, why not make one of them the lead character in the novel?" So he put James in, and it was like, well, that made my week. You know, it was absolutely fantastic. It's a real landmark thing for anyone who likes war games and writes. That was like, wow, that's wonderful. However, I've played a lot of Black Seas since then. I've played a lot of Armada. Of all of the Mantic games, Armada's the one I know the best now. And there's a little part of my soul that dies because I think he's overpriced and the rule is so situational. I would never, ever, ever buy James in the game because I think it's a terrible waste of points, which is really... really soul destroying. But I'm reliably informed on the Armada Fanatics page, because this has come up in conversation, that it's probably because I'm just not playing the game in the right style. Some people absolutely swear by him and say he's brilliant, he's that fleet's secret weapon, he's really good. I don't see it that way. I think it's a situational rule that you can spend a whole game and never use. In terms of, am I going to use that ability in Through Thick and Thin? Yeah, I've got a plan. I've got a plan for the final battle. I'm 80,000 words into the first draft of that, so for the end's in sight.
What is that special rule?
Right. It's about activation. So without going into the full mechanics of the game, in Armada, the wind is hitting the board from a certain direction. You draw a line from the wind, and that's your activation order every turn. So if you are upwind, you will activate first. James has got an ability where as soon as his ship activates and has finished its go, you can then pick a friendly ship within a certain distance, I think it's 8 inches, and say they're skipping activation order and I'm using them now. And you can do it once per game. And it's pretty expensive, and that's it. So I don't think that's that great, because first off you think, okay, I've got a bubble, I've got a circle around my ship. You don't, you have a semicircle. Because by the time the wind has hit you, anyone upwind has already activated. So you can only use it on people downwind. So you've got an 8-inch semicircle effect going downwind to use once to make a ship, a friendly ship, activate out of order. Which means for it to be of any advantage, an enemy ship must be between you. Otherwise, they were going to activate next anyway. So I don't think it's that great, but that's because I'm not very clever. From what people tell me, if you know that rule and you know how it works, you position your ships in such a way that you can use it. So you would go and flank an enemy capital ship, a main one, and then go, bang, I'm using it now. So you maneuver yourself to use James's special rule, and then it's really good. Apparently, I'm not clever enough.
I could see how that one, like, I'm not as well-versed in Armada as you are, probably, honestly. I've only played a handful of games with it, and I have a fleet. Mine's an orc fleet, but I could see how that could be potentially devastating, honestly. I'm just sitting here thinking about it, because there's similar rules in Kings of War, and those things, like the aura effect, like, you've got that circle of influence with it. That can actually be pretty massive if used in the right situation. So I don't know. I'd have to play more Armada to be able to tell you the truth, but yeah, I could see some potential applications for that.
Yeah, I think that's it. If the guy downwind is in a bigger ship, so you turn up with James in a frigate, something like that, and then you've got some monstrous, extra large ship downwind from you, yeah, you could probably do a lot of damage. Maybe I'll try it.
Yeah, yeah. That's a discussion we can have outside the podcast, but I think there's ways you can use it. Yeah.
Well, Mark, did you want to ask Ben your question you had?
When I wrote this Base Ilion saga, the plan was for 4 novels. I've written 3, so I'm supposed to do a 4th to draw it all together. But I hit a point where I just thought, will I, or shall I just end it there? I spoke to another Wing to Sar author, who's already on the books and done stuff. And he's read them all, and he said, I'll do it. And he came up with a synopsis, which was, to me, the Last Jedi of Wing to Sar novels. A really, really, really interesting story, which can make a great movie. But for me, as the creator of those characters, it showed a kind of a fundamental misunderstanding of those characters. Because that's not how they would do things. And that was kind of like, I feel like how George Lucas must have felt watching Luke Skywalker become a villain, a coward, and then die. That's like, that's how it must have felt. But it got me thinking for this, if I gave you the characters we've spoken about today, and might as well put it in that scenario and say, if Ben Stoddard is doing the 4th book to tie all this up, how would you tie it up? And what would you do with these characters?
Oh, man, there would be a lot more dead characters, I can promise you that. But that's kind of my MO. I'm definitely, you guys like your hopeful heroes. I like my heroes, you know, sufficiently broken. And so, I'll tell you where some of my influence comes. Have you guys ever seen the Nausicaa Valley of the Wind? It's one of the older Ghibli movies.
No, afraid don't.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Oh, you gotta watch that one. But like, I love redemption coming from sacrifice. I believe that any kind of redemption should be sacrificed. So with Orion, the idea in my head would be Orion and Estelle kind of already have the star-crossed lovers feel to them, and I feel like they would be reunited, but it would be at a very dire moment, and it's like, okay, we have closure on this relationship. Is it going to survive the night? Because are they going to make it out? And having those characters, see, I would almost have Estelle. Actually, this is an idea. I would probably have them build together. You've already set up that there's this extra threat that's threatening the world that both Catarin and Estelle have met together at the end of both books. Spoiler alert, sorry. But they've indicated that there's a bigger threat still going on, and building up against that fight and them racing to figure it out and finally figuring out, and that final battle being a desperate one. Honestly, the way I would tie up at least Orion and Estelle's story would be they would get together, they would finally, you know, reconcile, they'd realize that they have feelings for her, there would be that passionate moment. And then in the battle, Orion would sacrifice himself, because we've talked about how Estelle's whole thing is she needs other people, she wants to be loved and respected and remembered. And so subverting that by making it so that once Orion sacrifices himself, that Estelle then dedicates herself to propagating his legend and making sure that people understand that he is loved and he is the one, and making that a subverting that expectation of her desires.
Oh man, because that was a curveball I wasn't expecting.
But yes,
I think this is great.
That would be what I would do.
What's really interesting to me about that is that if say here's three novels, shove them at you, what, and straight away, I thought the whole romance between the two of them was tertiary in its importance. But it seems from people who've gone back to me that it isn't, and that's a real central theme. So it's really interesting that you picked that to go with as the driving force behind a storyline, a potential storyline for a fourth one.
Well, I think there's a lot of things you could play off of it with it. I mean, that wouldn't be the only storyline, because you still have Catarin that you have to put in there, and how she finds peace. She's already kind of found peace with her past, but it's apparent that she has forgiven them, but there's still that flake of bitterness, and realizing and rising above that final aspect of it in that battle and seeing something like Orion's sacrifice, or maybe she leads something that allows her to overcome that and realizes that, you know, this war is necessary in that we're fighting against an existential dread or an existential threat. But in all honesty, this garbage that's going on with the Duma and all that kind of stuff of we're politicking and we're worried about money rather than soldiers and lives and all of these people that are suffering because it costs too much to send an army north when they need it, and learning that that is where the real fight is, and using her authority that she can gain to be able to fight that and win some victory because of that, and maybe even being the reason that there is relief that comes to save the forces of Orion and Estelle or something along those lines because she wins that fight, I think could be a very intriguing second aspect or plot line that's of equal importance to Orion and Estelle, but her fight is against that, the kind of the red tape and the ridiculousness of the population. That would be what I would, that could be an avenue that I would pursue with that.
I'm scribbling notes down here.
Really, this whole thing was just a way for Mark to figure out how he's doing the fourth book.
Yep, done. Yeah, it's, oh no, I've got, there is a storyline which is agreed with Mantic, which I sent him a synopsis ages ago. Other things have jumped ahead in my schedule, but I have started writing it. I don't think it's a spoiler, it's a threat. At the moment, the way that the synopsis is written, one of the characters we have spoken about in these two episodes is not going to survive the fourth book. So a point of view character. So yeah, a point of view character isn't going to make it. So that's something, that's nice. But yeah, I have written, so where those two books end, and there's this fight between, or potential fight between Estelle and Catarin. I always found in movies, when it's like superhero movies, MCU stuff, when you have two heroes who meet and they have a misunderstanding and then there's a fight, and but something stops the fight, or they have a draw, or they trade quips and realise they're both on the same side. I really don't like that. So when those two do fight at the start of the book and there is a clear, unambiguous winner,
So yeah, I didn't want to sit on the fence on that. One of them really does kind of knock seven bells out the other. It's a long fight. It's a there's a clear winner. But Brandon, to hand over to you as chief editor, because I know you like a sad ending. Would you be happy with that for the fourth book?
Listen, you know my personal views on things. Where I had you change the ending to Steps. It was a little bit happier because it was more depressing the first version of it. We'll have discussions because I don't want to say too much that will make the audience go, well, we already know how the book's going to end. There's a viewpoint. I'm okay, and Ben knows this because you know we've worked on his book. I will not push an author to go in a certain direction unless they're comfortable going in that direction. And if the theme of the book lends itself to have a sad or, you know, whatever ending, then so be it. But if there's threads in the book to lead it to a happy ending, I don't want to have a sad ending just to have a sad ending. I mean, that's also sort of what we did with, real quick go into this, with Nature's Night between the three of us. I think there was, Ben, I think you and James wanted Dylan to kind of sacrifice himself and just kind of, I think we were originally talking about a more depressing ending for Dylan. And I went of the more marketing sense of saying, well, let's make it sort of bittersweet. So it's not a happy ending. It's not a sad ending. There's hope for Dylan. And there's a potential for him to return in other books or the sequel or whatever we want to do with him. I left it very vague as like, well, it's not happy, but it's not sad. So I think it all depends on the tone and the subject of the book.
I will say, though, what Ben's just come up with on the spot there, I think is 100 times happier than the alternate storyline we discussed a couple of weeks ago from another WHP author.
Yes.
it's so much more happier. Yeah, if I had to choose between those two, I'd pick Ben's in a heartbeat.
Well, we'll see. We'll talk about it.
Now I'm intrigued as to what's actually going to happen because you know me. I love the dark ending, so I'm okay with that.
All right, gentlemen. I think it's time we end it here. But you know there's still plenty to talk about. I mean, we didn't get even to the antagonist. Well, the tertiary antagonist of Hero Falling, who was kind of the anti-hero. I mean, there's a lot more characters we can talk about, and there's a lot more of Mark's style of writing we can talk about, and there's more we can talk about the novels. But if you guys want to see more of that, let us know. I think from what I just said, I think I want to plan for another Mark episode to talk about more of the Orion series. But if you guys want to see more, and if you want to see particular aspects of Mark's book, please let us know. Give us feedback and tell us what you want to see more of, what you want to see less of. Anything else you guys want to say before we wrap it up?
Friendly local gaming stores, I spoke about on my author's page. We had a local hero who has done so much good stuff for the community, for kids getting into the hobby. And this is on side of this guy who drives ambulances in his other time. He's an all-round hero. So it's with a heavy heart that my local friendly gaming store hasn't made it through the credit crunch and shut down recently. Just in case any of the locals here are listening, and just to say to V, thanks very much for everything you tried to do for the community over the last couple of years. It's been fantastic.
That's a rough topic. That's rough when a community center like that has to change and things like that. That's rough. I feel your pain, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, way to go from talking about endings to dropping like the heaviest, saddest thing that I didn't even know about. And we did. That's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Okay, I'll write a happy ending to the fourth novel then. I promise.
Gotta do something.
Ben, anything to brick our hearts
I was gonna say it's always a pleasure. Now it feels kind of trite to throw that in here at the end of that, kind of like a hey, just kidding. But no, I've enjoyed the conversation. It's always fun having these kind of conversation. I'm always happy to be on the podcast with you guys. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're absolutely gonna try to get Ben on more. But if you guys want to see more Ben, let us know, and we would always happy to have him back. There you are, ladies and gentlemen, Mark Barber, an author of many talents, series, and characters. If you've liked any of the novels that we talked about today, you can check them out on Amazon. Our website, whpsupplyroom.com, or any major book retailer. Again, if you want to help us out, ask your local bookseller to carry our products. We're distributed by Simon & Schuster, so they can order any of our novels directly from them, or from us even. You know, they can drop me a line, they can drop Vince a line, they can message us on Facebook to find out how to get the books directly to them. You know, we, any of our books, Kings of War, Infinity, Standalone, History, anything they can get from us. So please make sure you ask your local book retailer to stock us and support us. Gentlemen, thanks again for joining me here today. I'm Brandon Rossbaum.
I'm Mark Barber.
I'm Ben Stoddard.
And we'll see you guys in the next episode.